On this premiere episode of Under the Orange Roof, what the hell are we doing here? Well, it's my job to explain how we have gotten to this point, and with the 2021 baseball season so close to beginning, we will talk with Rays radio broadcaster Andy Fried about that beginning and plenty of others. My name is Steve Carney, and now that you're here, I'd really appreciate it if you hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode of the show, and follow us on Twitter at UTOR Podcast. And for the first time, let's go under the orange roof.
You're under the orange roof with Steve Carney.
Oh, it feels so good to hear that open. Thank you to Josh Grant, the longtime public address announcer for the Charlotte Stone Crabs and Rays spring training, for providing that for me. I'm doing this episode a little differently than I thought I was going to start out my podcast. And it all goes back to a few days ago. I was at a birthday party for my friend Lindsay Major, who works in Rays Vision, at Three Daughters Brewing, just pretty close to Tropicana Field. And I was hanging out, talking with a bunch of people, and I had a number of people go, "You know, I haven't heard you on the radio for a while. What's up?" And I realized that there are probably some people that don't realize that I am no longer at WDAE, the Rays flagship radio station, because I worked there for 15 years, and it was kind of weird that I'm no longer there. So I wanted to give you the full story of why this podcast has come into existence. And it started on November 13th. To give you a little bit of a backstory, 2020 sucked. Let's say that right off the bat. When the pandemic struck and spring training was paused, I was brought back from Port Charlotte, and after a day or so to kind of collect myself and get readjusted to being back here in the Tampa Bay area, my boss, my program director, John Mamola, said, "What we want to do is we want to put you in charge of the Pat and Aaron show," which is the midday show on WDAE. They had just lost their producer, and they were using some part-time board ops to run their show, and was kind of in limbo. And they said, "Well, we want to put you there." And I initially had pushed back because they wanted me to take a step back professionally, and that is nothing against Pat and Aaron, two guys that I like a lot and I respect a ton. But going from being a field guy and a host myself to going back to being a producer, something that I worked long and hard to get away from, I felt was a step back. But I also got the inference that if I had said no, that I was going to be furloughed when the furloughs came on April 1st. And they furloughed every part-time employee at the station, and everybody else that was there was forced to pick up a lot of the slack. And so for the entire 2020, I was working a lot throughout the day with Pat and Aaron, doing a lot of their show prep, doing their booking, making sure that all of their segments that they wanted to do, their situation men and their over under and segments like I Drink and I Know Things, which they came to adore, were all set up well. And on top of that, I was still doing my Rays duties, hosting a podcast 5 days a week, because we were doing a daily podcast about the Rays being the flagship station of the ball club. And then when baseball came back, that podcast went from 5 days a week to 7 days a week. And on top of all of the duties that they had thrown on me to be Pat and Aaron's producer, I was then back to doing my regular duties as the Rays beat reporter and the host of the Inside Pitch and everything that went along with that. So my days got very, very long. And because of the pandemic, I had not taken a vacation in 2020. So that will take you all the way until the week after baseball ended. I finally got a chance to take my first week of vacation out of four that I had, because I had been at the station for 15 years. I had accrued 4 weeks of vacation a year. So I was taking the very first week that I had, and I had 4 days off that were just unbelievably good because I was rested, I was relaxed, I was ready for what was going to come up, because I was still doing Buccaneers football as well on the weekends. And then came February 13th, the Friday the 13th. And at about 8:15 in the morning, I got a phone call from a number that came up on my caller ID as iHeartMedia Tampa Bay, but it was a number that I had not recognized. And when I answered the phone, it was Chris Sektik, who is the market manager for iHeartMedia Tampa Bay, and Tommy Chuck, the senior vice president of programming. And they were very polite. They were very cordial, but they told me almost immediately that I was being laid off by iHeartMedia Tampa as part of their reduction in force when it comes to, the amount of money that they were losing because of the pandemic. They had a stretch where they laid off people, I don't know, for 5 weeks. I mean, it started at the beginning of November, and it ran through, I want to say, either the first or the second week of December. So it was either 5 or 6 weeks that they were laying off people left and right throughout the country. I was not the only person that was let go by iHeartMedia Tampa Bay. I was not the only person that was let go in this market. There were a number of guys that were let go that had been there longer than I had been, which is amazing to think, because for WDAE, there was only one person that had been there longer than me, and that was Ron Diaz. But they were very good about it, and I was able to collect a severance, and I was able to work on what my next step was going to be. Now, I thought that maybe I was going to move out of the area and maybe take a radio job someplace else. And I looked at that for a little while, but I also looked at, what do I love? I love baseball. I loved covering the Tampa Bay Rays. I loved talking about the Tampa Bay Rays. And I wanted to continue doing that. And so immediately my second thought was, well, why don't you start a website and resume podcasting? And this time around, it's going to be better for me, because this time around, I own my podcast. That was the one thing about the Inside Pitch podcast. And I loved doing the Inside Pitch podcast, but it wasn't mine. I created it, but I did not own it. And now, because of the things that have gone on in my life over the last, almost 3 months, I am now able to have relationships with sponsors, and I am able to have ownership of this podcast. And it's something that I'm very excited about, and I hope that you're very excited about. If you're here for episode one, if you're getting in on the ground floor, it could not be a better statement to me of the support that I have. And I thank you so much for this opportunity. So it is a new beginning for me, just like it's going to be a new beginning for the Tampa Bay Rays here coming up in less than 2 weeks as spring training gets going. We are here getting ready for the team to go down to Port Charlotte. As things stand right now, Major League Baseball has said we are going to have a regular spring training and we are going to have a regular 162-game season. After what happened last year in the pandemic, I certainly think that that is a great thing for baseball fans. I know that the 60-game season that we had last year, it was fun. It was a sprint, but that's not baseball. It seemed like we were right in the playoffs right from the beginning, And thankfully for Tampa Bay, they were able to go 40-20 during that sprint to get to the postseason and then make it all the way to the World Series and get all the way to Game 6 before losing to the Los Angeles Dodgers. And now we begin again here in 2021, and the beginning is going to look a lot different than what we saw in 2020. But that's what life is. That's what baseball is. It's a new beginning every single time out. I hope you're ready for 2021. I hope you're ready for this new beginning. I hope you're ready to be excited for this challenge that's coming up as a baseball fan. Thankfully that the Rays are planning on having fans at Tropicana Field this year. And so now we see what 2020 is going to bring. This first episode, I was able to sit down with my good friend, a guy that I've known a long, long time, Andy Freed, Rays radio broadcaster. I've known Andy since 2006, when in his second year with the club, they used to come in, him and Dave Wills, and at that time, Rich Herrera, who was their pregame and postgame show host, and Dwayne Statz and Joe McGrain used to come in and do radio shows getting ready for the start of the regular season. And we would have those guys in studio, and we would have guests either by phone or in studio sometimes. And that was the first time I ever got to meet Andy, and he and I clicked almost immediately. We found out, that we were very, very similar because we're both coming from Rhode Island. I was born and raised in Rhode Island. Andy, before getting the job with the Tampa Bay Rays, was the play-by-play guy for the Pawtucket Red Sox, the AAA affiliate of the Boston Red Sox, based in Rhode Island. And we spent many a days at McCoy Stadium, probably together at times. But it's just amazing to think that I've known Andy for this long. I consider him a great friend. And when I decided that I wanted to start this podcast and I wanted this podcast to be about beginnings, I was going to go right to Andy Freed for the first episode. So let's sit down and spend some time under the orange roof with our good friend, Andy Freed. Yeah, I couldn't think of anybody who could be a better first guest for this show than my good friend Andy Freed, Rays radio broadcaster, who I have known now, oh God, it's been forever. 2006 was the first time I met you, Andy, and I remember it was for spring training, and you and Dave had come in to do a whatever the name of the show was at that time. It's gone through so many iterations. Countdown to opening day, hot stove edition of Rays baseball. It's just hilarious to think of everything that it's gone through. It's amazing to think that, you know, this is going to be season number 17 coming up with you and Dave Wills being one of the longest tenured broadcast teams in all of Major League Baseball. I want to go back to that first beginning, though, Andy. 2005, you get your start with Dave here in Tampa Bay. But take us through the beginning, what it took, because you were in Pawtucket for a few years before coming to the Rays. Take us through, you know, when you found out that there was going to be a possibility to make the move from AAA to the major leagues and what it took to get to the point where the Rays said, okay, you're our guy.
Well, first of all, thank you. And it's an honor to be your first guest. And yes, we've known each other for quite a long time now. And I've often thought, Steve, that you being from Rhode Island, and I worked in Rhode Island for 4 years, I have to think at some point we were probably near each other, next to each other, walked by each other or something in the smallest state, when we're both sports fans, and we probably passed by each other at McCoy Stadium up there at some point in time.
Probably.
Before we actually knew each other out here in Florida. But my 4 years in Pawtucket were certainly interesting, but that was the end of what ended up being 11 years in the minor leagues. And, going from Port St. Lucie, Florida, to Trenton, New Jersey, to Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and spending 11 years in the minors doing it was what I think of as like getting a postgraduate degree in baseball as an industry and broadcasting as an industry, because it really teaches you from the grassroots level what it takes to help run a franchise. So by the time I got to the Rays and the major leagues, I felt like I had an understanding, not only an understanding, but an intimate, deep understanding of what it takes from dozens of people to run an organization, whether it be from a community relations standpoint, public relations, sales, what the GM has to do, running a staff, having people that not only that you work for, but people that then work for you. I've been in that situation before through the minors. So it really gave me a wonderful education on what it takes to be a franchise. So, I had applied for quite a while for different jobs throughout the minor leagues up into the major leagues. And I had gotten pretty close with a couple of other teams, but didn't get the gig. And so when finally I got the offer from the Rays, I had been through the situation before when you get the phone call and it's like, you know, we loved the interview with you. We thought it was great, but so, you know, and then, you know, but
that but's
means
awful.
That we're going to go with somebody else. With the Rays, the phone call was, it was great. We love the interview. We think you'd be a great fit. And I was like, ooh, I've never heard the and before. I always heard the but before. So the and came and they offered me the job. And as you know, it is very rare that a team would be hiring two play-by-play announcers at the same time. But the Rays were taking the rights in-house. So they kind of wanted to start fresh and new. And the other two guys, Paul and Charlie, that were here, they went on to other things. And that Dave and I were hired on the same day, February 1st, 2005. And you go from the minor leagues to suddenly being in Lou Piniella's office within a couple of weeks. And it was quite a transition. We didn't think the team would be any good, and they weren't. But I didn't care. It was just a blast being in Major League Baseball.
What did you know about Dave before you started working with him? Because I mean, Dave is a legend. Let's not beat around the bush. I mean, Dave Wills is one of the most popular people that I've ever met around baseball. I don't know a single person that doesn't like Dave, that doesn't enjoy being around Dave. But what did you know about the guy that was going to be your partner before you signed on with him?
Zero. I knew nothing about Dave Wills until we met at FanFest in 2005. I had heard that there was a guy that had gone from single A to doing pre and post game with the White Sox. And I remember hearing that sometime around the and that was Dave. I didn't know him, but you know, as you know, Dave was doing some stuff while working for the radio station, and then he had an opportunity to do pre and post for the White Sox, which was quite a jump, you know, from low minor leagues to the majors. But his point, and a great point, is that, you know, he was working for a even in the minor leagues. Why did he have to go to, you know, some nowhere place in double A ball to get more experience? I mean, why did he have to do that? And he stuck to his guns and he of course was right. And Dave's talented. I mean, you know, the thing that I remember from the first time I met him to today is we're, you know, I say best friends, we're almost like brothers really, you know, we see each other more than our wives during the season. And we're in constant contact around the year. Is that there's nothing phony about Dave. And I love that about him. And he says that about me too. I think that's kind of why we get along. You know, if we have a rough moment, we do it, we get it out of the way, and then you move forward. And those are pretty rare also. But there's just nothing phony. And we both come from the minor leagues. We have a great appreciation and sense of wonder that we're here together, that we've made it through this remarkable trip through the minor leagues and into Major League Baseball. I know a lot of guys that are talented that haven't gotten this opportunity. There's nobody that I like to gripe to after a bad loss. There's nobody like that I like to celebrate with after a Rays win than Dave. Dave's a one-man party. He is of the people. He can celebrate like nobody else can. He loves being the center of attention when we're out and about, which is just fine with me because I don't mind being a wallflower. He can he can get loud and stuff, and I tend to kind of shrink in the corner, but I love the guy. You know, we've been together now, and it's just so funny to think that we were sitting there at FanFest at Tropicana Field in 2005 and didn't know each other, and it all worked out.
Yeah, it's amazing to think. And the one-man party, that is the perfect – That's the perfect thing to describe, Dave. Yeah, you guys are so great together, and the nuances and everything that comes with being together for 17 years on the air. I mean, obviously shows, and The Athletic had an article this past year talking about the best broadcasting teams in radio. And you guys finished behind Kuiper and Kruko, and that's it, which I think it's an incredible thing to think of, and how people, especially here in Tampa Bay, just love listening to the radio and the ratings. Having worked for WDAE for as long as I did, I can tell you exactly how popular Rays radio broadcasts are. But that sort of chemistry doesn't grow overnight. What sort of growing pains did you guys have to deal with?
Surprisingly, very little. And I mean, maybe some over the course of time. We have had a crossword over 17 years, maybe two or three times, I'm going to say. And I don't think we've had one since 10, 11, 12 years. I mean, and I say crossword, you work with somebody every day. At some point, somebody's in a bad mood and somebody snips at somebody else. But that's no different than someone that works in an office. You know, it's nothing that's lasted. Very infrequently do we ever have anything but really kind of fun. We kind of came up with this at the very beginning that, you know, whatever the team is, the team could be good, the team could be bad, we could be doing a spring training game, we could be doing a World Series game, whatever, we're going to lead the league in fun. How can you not? And that's where the perspective of coming through the minor leagues really is, because once you've done the overnight bus trips, once you've pulled tarp, once you've done all the things that you really don't want to have to do in order to get to the broadcast at the end of the day for a night game in the minor leagues, this is just... I mean, it's phenomenal. it's the greatest gig in the world. You know, we met each other at FanFest. We went out to dinner that night in St. Pete, and it was remarkably easy. I mean, it was – the conversation just flowed. I wanted to learn about him. He wanted to learn about me. It was just very, very easy. And then the funny part of it, when I look back, you know, Vince Namoli was still owning the team at the time. We had already been hired. We had already moved down with our families. He had a 9-year-old at the time. I had a almost 2-year-old at the time. You know, our wives are dead. We moved down. And then Vince says, well, I want these guys to do a practice broadcast in spring training. And Dave and I are like, so what? If this doesn't go great, do we have to go back? I mean, is there a receipt? Are they going to return us? But we're like, okay, we'll do that. And we did, you know, into a tape recorder, for goodness sake. So we broadcast a couple of innings of a spring training game. I think it was in Dunedin. It was either in Dunedin or Sarasota. I don't remember. Spring training of 2005. And the thing that I do remember about it is that it clicked. You know, there's something about when you're working with somebody, you call it chemistry, and I guess it is what it is, where the other person starts to talk right when the other person stops. And we weren't talking over each other at all. I seemed to get where he was with his timing, and he seemed to get where I was going to stop with my sentences. And what you hear now is pretty much what happened that first day. I don't know how chemistry happens. I don't know why it happens. But by and large, when it happens, it's unmistakable. And I've worked with other people where it takes time for that to happen. With Dave, it didn't take any time. It just naturally happened. And thankfully, I guess Vince liked the tape because he allowed us to broadcast for that next year until he sold the team to Stu.
It's funny that you mention the sale of the team, because that's the next beginning. You know, we've talking a lot about beginnings here, and there was the stretch there at the very beginning, the hiring of you and Dave, the sale of the team to Stu, and the hiring of Joe Maddon as a manager that changed how a lot of people viewed this team, first here locally and then nationally when 2008 came around.
Yeah, you know, that first year I look back, and I mean, I really was like a wide-eyed kid. you know, suddenly I was in the big leagues, and, you know, I dreamed of doing this for so long, Steve, that I was only set up really to be let down because you put things up on such a high pedestal of what it would be to actually get to the major leagues. And the thing was, and I still say it to this day, and I mean it to this day, when you dream about something for so long and then you get it, you'd think that the only way would be down. But not only has it been as good and as satisfying creatively that I would had hoped and dreamed it would be, but even better. It's been a complete dream come true. You know, people say all the time, well, you know, do you want to do more of this? National radio, television, national television. I feel good. I feel like I've already won. You know, I'm very satisfied creatively. I work with a guy that I love. I work for a team that I love. And I've gotten a chance to grow up with that team. You know, that first year, I look back and I was like a wide-eyed kid in that I got everything that I ever wanted. But the team stunk, but okay, I'm still there. Then when they were sold by the end of the year, everything took a very different tone, a much more relaxed tone, because of the ownership of Stu Sternberg. And then when Joe came along, I mean, talk about meeting a guy that would enrich your life. I mean, that's what Joe did, just as a friend, and you know him. I mean, he's just such a wonderful man to be around, and we were lucky enough to be able to get time with him every day, and a friendship really blossomed with Dave and I and Joe. You know, we all got along so well that, I mean, then the team got good, and then it's like, this is even better. I mean, it just got better and better and better. And, you know, and now you're at the point where we've been doing this so long that, you know, I feel so emotionally invested in the team that when they're doing great, I got more of a bounce in my step. You can't help but be attached to something that you've been a part of for so long. So, and that's really part of the joy of this industry.
When I know, and having talked to Joe, and as you mentioned, you know, I've known Joe now since 2006 when he came to town. We had him on the radio station day one, and you know, and we've gotten along really well over the course of my time from, you know, the time that I was running your board doing Rays broadcasts and he would call in to do things for DAE to the times where I would start going to the Trop. And that was in 2011. And we'll get to 20 that year here in just a second. But I know Joe always said that the day that he thought that this was going to get turned around was the day that Andrew Friedman made the deal to bring in Dan Wheeler and traded Ty Wigginton to the Houston Astros. I actually think it may be a little earlier than that. What do you think is the point where you went, you know what, this is going to be a really good team?
Oh, geez. I mean, I didn't buy into it probably as much as other people did until about, I'm going to say maybe June of 08.
Oh, wow.
I can tell you the conversation that turned it around for me is that, I mean, I was, you know, I could see we were trying to build something, but, you know, for those that don't know, and many I'm sure listening know, but for those that don't know, I mean, the Tampa Bay Devil Rays were a national joke. Mm-hmm. You know, Letterman would have, you know, the Devil Rays as like a punchline on the top 10 list. You know, they were just completely obliterated by Boston, New York. There was no way they could really ever go anywhere, right? In the American League East, there was no chance. Well, I mean, we still were a last-place team in 2007. I mean, there were some inklings that they were getting better. But I remember in spring training thinking, if we could get to within a couple of games of 500, that would seem like a real victory. And then 08 starts, and they start gelling, and they start not only winning – but beating Boston, beating New York, sweeping the Red Sox at home in April that year, not looking intimidated by those teams anymore, winning series. You know, it used to be like when we, for example, when we faced the Blue Jays, I remember going into series and I'd say, all right, what day is Halliday going to pitch? Because the day he pitches, we're probably not going to win. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could win one of the other two. Well, it started to get to the point where we beat Roy Halliday. You know, and that seemed like, wow, that's pretty cool. I remember it got to June of that year, and we were in first place, but like it was close. You know, it was about maybe a half a game up or back, and I remember being in Joe's office. And, you know, Joe, for being the eternal optimist, was also and still is quite a realist. You know, and with Dave and I behind the scenes, we'd hear a lot of the stuff that you don't hear publicly. So when you know, he was always positive publicly, but behind the scenes, he was always quick to point out what might be a flaw here or there. That's the nature of being critical. That's what a manager does. And I can remember I remember saying to him, I said, Joe, at what point here, are you buying into this for a full season as much as everyone else is? I said, because I still, you know, when you're with the team every day, you see their warts. You see, you know, we don't have this. We don't really have a closer. We don't really have a bench like the other, you know, we don't have this. And as he goes, Andy, I am at the point now where if we don't make the playoffs, I will be not only surprised, but extremely disappointed. And I walked out of his office going, whoa, that's a guy that is being really realistic, that is saying this team is about to do something big. From that point on, and I think it was around mid-June, from that point on, that was the perspective I had that this team really could go somewhere. And then, as you know, because you were with us, they had this magical season and Dan Johnson homers, and they make it through the postseason and get all the way to the World Series. And, you know, that was the great thing where they jumped the line. You know, you're supposed to, right, in sports, you get better incrementally. Well, this team went from terrible to the class of the league, and I really do feel that it's the closest thing that baseball has had to the 69 Mets since the 69 Mets, the 08 Rays. I wish they had won the series, because I believe in my heart of hearts they were the best team in baseball that year. I think they were better than the Phillies. The Phillies were better that week, but I think the Rays were the better team. And look, that counts. The Phillies won fair and square. But the Rays went from worst team in baseball to best team in baseball, and no one could convince me otherwise.
Yeah, and the best part about it was that the Rays had the number one pick that year. So they also got a top of the draft guy. Unfortunately, we all know what happened with that. I'm not even going to mention his name. Tim.
Yep.
But for me, 08 was funny because, you know, you started off, and I remember, you know, producing the 07 season and going, okay, when is Shields going to pitch? Because I knew that was going to be a good game. You know, the other games, you know, could Kazmir have a good game? Sure, but probably, you know, it would be a coin flip for him. You know, it was certainly... you know, were you going to get a good game from Edwin Jackson at that point? I mean, they still had Jay So and guys like that were still rounding out the rotation. You were going, okay, I don't know. For me, when Andrew decided that a second place finish in the American League Rookie of the Year was enough of a high for Delmon Young that they could go get Jason Bartlett and Matt Garza, I was like, okay, I'm buying in. That's a pretty good move. And that's, for me, that's when I went, ooh, they think that they can do something. And then when they come out and they have a, you know, the gelling, and we can go back to spring training that year watching Francisco Cervelli get bowled over by Elliot Johnson and everything that happened there, because that was the announcement that we're nobody's pushovers this year. And all of that, and then Nathan Haynes off of Mariano Rivera. And I just remember Dave's call of Nathan Haynes, of all people, with the big hit that gave the Rays the lead at Yankee Stadium. And then the back-to-back nights, and I was at the end of May and the beginning of June, so about the same time, with Cliff Floyd and Gabe Gross hitting walk-off homers on back-to-back nights. This team's got something, because everybody is contributing.
Oh, without a doubt. And you know, it was the first time, too. I remember that off-season, Joe, talking to Joe at one point in fact, it was at his Thanksgiving thing, if I recall, him saying, we got some stuff in the pipeline that I can't tell you yet because they're not sure, but I think we're going to be getting some guys that you're going to be excited about. And what he was talking about was getting some veteran guys. You know, the, the Rays really hadn't taken on veteran players. And suddenly they had Trevor Miller, and they already had Wheeler, and they brought in Percival, and they brought in Floyd, and they brought in Hinsky, and guys that had been through it before. And that really added a lot to that team. And they really haven't done a whole lot of veteran adding since, when you think about it. They still have, if anything, have doubled down on going with the youth. But that was really important for that year. And I can remember in 06 and 07 talking to Andrew Friedman about, well, how are we going to do this? You know, at the time, the teams that were kind of the sexy teams, so to speak, were the Twins and the Indians on how they were building things up, because they're still those, you know, medium to small market teams and the way they operate. I mean, the Twins are almost contracted, for goodness sake, and the Indians are always kind of teetering on the edge. And I remember saying to him, are we going to do this like the Twins do it? Like, are we going to do this the way the Indians do it? And he said, no, we're going to do this the way we're going to do it. And I'm like, wow, they really have much more of a plan than I realize. And boy, did they stick with that plan. And the beauty of that is there have been lots of teams that have had plans before. Oh, we've got a five-year plan, we've got this or that. But they deviate from it when things get tough. The Rays, to this day, are not afraid to get publicly scorned nationally. They're not afraid to get criticized. They really believe in what they're doing. I mean, whether it works or not. You know, game six, Blake Snell taken out of the World Series. You know, they stick by that decision because that's what they had planned to do. So, I mean, you'll take some lumps, but when it works, everybody copies you. And I think every other team in their own way copies what the Rays have done.
Yeah, and that beginning went, you know, well, I think a lot longer than a lot of people realize, because, you know, 08 and then 2010, they win the American League East as well. And 2009, I think, is kind of I put an asterisk by it, because, you know, 2009, they weren't a bad team either. But for the fact that Carlos Pena broke his finger when he got hit by a pitch by CC Sabathia, and missed the entire month of September, and JP Howell burned his arm out because he played in the World Baseball Classic that year. And I thought that, you know, if they had those two guys, I think that they are contending in 2009 as well. But then they start what the next beginning, and to, you know, it's like the song, it feels like starting over when 2011 came around, because you lose Carl Crawford, you end up having to move on from Matt Garza, you end up trading Matt Garza to Chicago, and you know, Kaz gets moved, and you know, all these pieces that you saw that got them to 2008, 2009, 2010 all end up getting moved, and then 2011 starts out as bad. That maybe this is why the Rays decided to stay away from veteran going out and getting veterans. They go out and they get Johnny Damon and Manny Ramirez. Ramirez lasts all of five games with the Rays. By the way, I'll tell this story to you, because this I'm sure will make you laugh. My Manny Ramirez as a Rays story. There's actually two pieces. I'll never forget at the press conference where they introduced both Johnny and Manny. I think it was Bill Chastain of MLB.com asked them about playing 162 games. And I'll never forget, Manny looked at Bill and said, yeah, we can play 162 games. Johnny will play 100 and I'll play 62. And, you know, lit the crowd up. I mean, we were all laughing. We all had a good time. I mean, and then one of the last days that Manny was, it may have been the last day Manny was there before he got suspended. We're waiting for Joe outside of the dugout to do his pregame availability with us. And for people that don't get how things work in baseball, you talk to the manager before the game and you get all the stuff that you may be looking to do, feature pieces or, you know, stuff that, you know, big picture stuff comes before the game, specific things you talk to the manager about after the game. And so we were waiting for Joe to come out from talking to you and Dave, because he would be in there talking to you and Dave for however long, you know. If you listen to the broadcasts on the radio, you know, it's a 6 or a 7 minute piece at that point. But I mean, Joe is in there with you guys for like 45 minutes sometimes.
We would monopolize
it. Having been on the inside of that, I understand that, and it's great. So we're waiting for Madden, and you know, the guys are out doing stretch, they're getting ready for BP, and we're standing around, and Manny runs by, and this was Laura McKeeman, now Laura Rutledge's first year with the team, and she had only been around for 4 or 5 games herself. And he looks at her and he goes, "Hey, you dropped your pen." And she bent over at the waist and did a full 360 like she was doing the dizzy bat race. and he did the finger point, you know, that he was known for. And he walked in and he jogged down into the tunnel. And that was the last time I saw Manny Ramirez, because he was suspended the next day. So the final time I ever saw Manny Ramirez was that. And so I knew you would love that story. But that was a starting over point, because we were like, I'm sure that you thought the same thing. You know, what are we doing? You know, this is going to be awful. No Crawford, no Garza. We just saw Manny Ramirez get suspended. We're going to put Sam Fold out there full time in left field to make so Johnny Damon doesn't need to use his noodle arm for 6 innings before we pull him from the game. And all of a sudden, and then you start out 0-5 or 0-6 going on the road to Chicago, and somehow team wins 90 games and you end up winning the wild card in one of the craziest calls of all time that you got to call.
Can you believe that's 10 years ago? I was just thinking about that. I mean, that's going to be 10 years ago in September, that season. But, you know, also from that 2000, you know, a lot of things were built in the organization for 2010. But when I say in 08 they jumped the line, they'd not only jumped other teams, they jumped ahead of where they thought they were going to be. I think the franchise was kind of expecting that by 2010 it could be a really, really good team, which is why they had, you know, plan to hold on to Crawford through free agency and et cetera. But once, you know, they were really good. But, you know, after 2010, they not only lost the guys that you're mentioning, Crawford and Garza, they lost Rafael Soriano, who was their closer, Joaquin Benoit, their setup man, and Grant Balfour, who was who could have been a closer. It was like losing 3 closers, you know, out of that bullpen. And as you had mentioned, too, I mean, J.P. Howell had been hurt. He was just trying to come back. They brought up this kid, Jake McGee, to see what he could. I mean, there were very low expectations internally of what 2011 would be, to the point where it's mid-August, and I can remember being in Baltimore, and Stu is there meeting with Andrew and Matt, not about what are we going to do for this season. It was about, okay, you know, what are our plans for the future here? They're, you know, they had written off internally that this was going to be a playoff team. In 2011, they were, what, double figures or so behind the Red Sox, not to mention behind the Yankees. So, you know, that was miracle upon miracle upon miracle. But and as you remember, it was a two-team dance. It was the Rays playing well. And, you know, it's not like they went on a 15-game winning streak. They just were winning series. And the Red Sox, it's not like they lost 15 in a row. They were just losing series. So you were picking up. Like, it's Wednesday, we picked up another game. Oh, it's Sunday, we just picked up another game. Oh, it's Thursday, we just picked up 2 games this week. And suddenly what had been, you know, I forgot what the numbers were, a 9 or 12 game disadvantage, was suddenly down to like 5 with a couple of weeks to go. And then I can remember Dave and I saying to each other, let's just really put a scare into the Red Sox. You know, they're the better team, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not going to catch them. Let's just put a real scare into them. And we went to Fenway and won 3 out of 4, and got it to, I forgot what it was, maybe 2 or something like that, with still a week plus to go. We were like, oh my God, you could, and you know, New England, you could feel the tension on. I mean, that team was playing about as tight as a team could. And the Rays were playing about as loose. They had nothing to lose. And it was so pleasurable to watch the Red Sox crumble little, but it was like the slow death, you know, piece by piece, they were falling apart, and the Rays just were gaining ground. And it was really the tortoise and the hare. And in the 11th hour of the 11th day, at the end, they sneak by and by a nose. And it was such a shock. It was so pleasurable. And it was just, as you know, being a Rays fan, having sand kicked in your face by Red Sox and Yankees, it was so pleasurable to nose out the Red Sox and see the shock that really went through their organization, because that was the end of Francona with the Red Sox, and they made so many different changes after that because of what the Rays were able to do to them.
Yeah, the
so
end
much
of
fun.
The end of Francona, the end of Theo.
Yeah.
You know, that was the beginning of the end on their end as well. You know, you mentioned, you know, all the, you know, Stu coming to Baltimore to talk to Matt and to Andrew. I remember that there was a time, and this was at the beginning of August. So this was right after the trade deadline. I was doing This Week in Rays Baseball because Rich Herrera, the pregame and postgame show host at the time, had a family thing, and so he was gone for a weekend, and so I needed to they had myself and Derek Sharp do This Week in Rays Baseball, and I got to do the feature interview, and it was with Sean Rodriguez, and I remember they had sent Reed Brignac down to the minors, and Sean was going to play shortstop at that point. They wanted Sean to play shortstop every day. And I remember we were sitting in the dugout, and I said to him, I said, you know, I know the old adage is that you learn a lot more about yourself and your teammates when times are tough than when times are well. What have you learned about yourself and your teammates this year? And he looked at me and he went, bro, I learned that we got a whole lot more baseball to play. And I said, you're absolutely right. And, but he had that feeling at that point that, you know, we're a hell of a lot better than people are thinking. And I remember that after game 162, and I'm going to ask you about game 162 here in a second, during all the celebration that was going on, and you know, we had talked to, you know, all the heroes, and we had talked to Sam Fold, we had talked to Dan Johnson, we had talked to Evan. I went over and I stood, I was standing next to Jeff Niemann, trying to, you know, use him as a shield for some of the champagne because he was such a big dude. And Sean Rodriguez sidled up next to me, and he put his arm around my shoulder, and he went, huh? And I turned to him and I said, dude, you have no idea how happy I was to be wrong.
Yeah.
And he laughed and he gave me a big hug, and you know, we continued on through that night. But that night was so crazy for so many reasons. And we all, if you remember watching the game at home, you know, you probably had a second television. That because Major League Baseball Network was around at that point, so you could see, you know, the game and game type stuff. How did you how were you getting the news about, okay, the Red Sox and the Orioles have gone into a rain delay, okay, now it's back, and now everything that happened with Papelbon in the ninth inning, was it from what did you guys have something going on the side? Was Dave playing on his laptop? Did you have yours out there? How were you guys getting that information?
Well, it's the first pennant race that I remember with Twitter, and really Twitter has become a big part of the broadcast in the respect that it's affected everybody's life, is that you can find out what's happening in other places in real time. That was the first year that Dave and I had it, so we were able to keep track through that, and we all had our laptops up, and with MLB.tv, mm-hmm. We had their game on. I remember by the time postseason came along, it was kind of cool to just watch a game that we were broadcasting, because we spent all of September watching what was going on with the Red Sox as our game was going on. And the other thing about it too was that it was the first time in a pennant race that I remembered that the fans were experiencing it that way also. You know, you could hear at Tropicana Field that night, because everybody was looking down at their phones as they were watching the game, what was happening in Baltimore. So they were reacting and finding out what was going on before the players knew, and because the players were playing. And you know, we were all finding out long before the Rays actually were. So we, you know, it was a constant monitoring of what was going on there, what was going on with us at the same time. And you know, when the Rays fell behind 7-0 that night, and David Price has just had a miserable night in falling behind, the two homers to Teixeira, the grand slam, they bring in Juan Cruz, he gives up a home run to Andrew Jones, and it's 7-0 so quickly that I really do remember putting my head down on my desk at one point going, this was so sweet, and it's a shame that it's going to end like this, but all right, you know, we had a great run. It was so much fun. And then it starts raining in
the
Baltimore.
Eighth inning.
It starts raining, and they're in a delay, and they're watching us come back. And I often think of what it must have been like for the Red Sox sitting in the clubhouse in Baltimore during their torturous rain delay, and they saw Sean Rodriguez get hit by a pitch. Or was it Sam Fold? I can't remember. One of them got hit by a pitch.
Both of them did.
Both of them did. Okay, got hit by a pitch to not going to run. BJ gets a sacrifice fly. I think Kochman had a hit in there at one point. Mm-hmm. Evan hits the 3-run home run, and it's 7-6. And they're helpless. It's 7-6. And then still, it was still raining in Baltimore. They were still in a delay when Dan Johnson hits the home run in the bottom of the ninth inning. And I've often thought they must have been like, you know, when Rocky won, when Apollo can't believe that Balboa is coming out of the corner for that final round, and he has that look on his face like, I can't shake this guy. They had to have been thinking it like that. And then they go out and blow the game, and the Rays come back. I mean, it was just, I'll tell you what, I've never heard it again, but I've heard it once, the Red Sox broadcast from that night, even during the rain delay, and hearing the energy drain out of the announcers of the Red Sox as the Rays are coming back. And then hearing it, how it happened from their vantage point from a broadcast, for them, they must have just been nauseous and sick. And for us, it was just about as pleasurable a situation as you could ever have. And to this day, there's never been a night in baseball before or since like September 28th, 2011.
No, it's absolutely incredible. And it's funny that the next year's MLB video game on PlayStation has the whole Game 162 story played out, and they show Dan Shaughnessy on NESN talking about how, I think that the Red Sox are going to be playing on here, and the Rays are going home, which just makes me laugh. And then you hear Don Orsillo's call from NESN that night, and now the Red Sox hands are in the fate of the fans in St. Pete.
We all know too that once the Red Sox lost and the game is tied here, you know, with the Rays and Yankees, there was no way the Rays were going to lose. Yeah. Once the Red Sox blew it, you know, somehow, some way, the Rays were going to squeeze across one run. And frankly, I don't even know if the Yankees cared. You know, they were sticking with Scott Proctor probably to the end of the night. They didn't use Rivera. They didn't use their A relievers because they were getting ready for postseason. They started Betances for an inning that night. So it meant nothing to them, and you just knew that the Rays were going to somehow score a run. And then it just happened to be a home run, and it happened to be Evan, and it happened to be this weird line driver. I remember when that ball left the bat, Steve, you know, from you watch enough baseball, and you can kind of tell off the bat usually what something is going to be, mm-hmm. if it's in the gap, if it's, you know, whatever. Off the bat, I thought, oh, there's a double into the corner.
Yep.
The fact that the thing snuck over the tiny wall and left was just ridiculous. I could not believe that it went over the wall. I don't think Evans ever hit a home run quite like that before or since. And then the topping, of course, Crawford couldn't handle the line drive and left that lost the game for the Red Sox. And the fact that Evan hits it over the Crawford corner where they lower the left field wall for Carl Crawford. For all those years he was with the Rays, it could not have been scripted better. And that's what makes sports great, is that, you know, those moments so rarely happen. But when they do, it was almost like, it was almost cinematic. It was like watching a movie.
Yeah, it really was. And I remember the next day I went into the radio station and I said, I've got the perfect piece. I've the perfect promo for the playoffs this year. And it was to get our voice guy to go, don't worry, Red Sox fans. You'll still get to see Carl Crawford in the playoffs. We left him a ticket at will call.
I never heard that.
No, they decided they weren't going to do it, and I was like, "Oh, come on, you sons of."
That's too bad. They should have.
It would have been so funny, but that and that signified the next starting over. But then 2014 comes around. We had the great 2013 finish, which I don't think people realize how much. How much tension there was having to, you have to win in Toronto the last day of the season, and then you have to go to Texas to play game 163, and then you have to go to Cleveland to play the one game wild card, and then get to Boston for the American League Division Series. 2014 happens, and you start seeing the slide off. There was some decisions that I know that fans were very, very now you say concerned. You're giving multi-year deals to guys like Yunel Escobar and Jose Molina, and then as when the 2014 season ends and Joe and Andrew are gone, and now we are starting over with Kevin Cash. And as much as we love Joe and as much as we love Kevin Cash, there are two very similar people that go about things very differently, right?
Well, they're both baseball lifers, and that's how they're similar. They're both, Joe used to.
They're both former catchers.
They're both former catchers, and Kevin was the much better player, of course, than Joe was. Kevin minimizes his talent as a player, but Kevin was a very good baseball player.
Yes,
he
was.
He may not have had great numbers in the big leagues, but this is a real gym rat of a guy that just loves being at the ballpark and lives and breathes it. And so does Joe. Joe always, to this day, refers to himself, he goes, "I'm just a minor league grunt." And, Kevin's that kind of way, too. And, 2014, Steve, people have talked a lot about this year and the predictions for the Rays. And, 2014 is the only year that I remember that the national prognosticators were predicting really good things for the Rays. That no one predicted in 08. In 09, they thought the Yankees, because they spent literally $1 billion, and they were right. People didn't think they were going to win the division in 2010, certainly not in 11. 12, they didn't think that. And 13, they were a bit of a surprise. But finally, they won over the national people that cover the team. And there was a lot of people predicting that the Rays would win the American League East. And that was a very different feeling going into that season. And I remember opening day was really good that year. They beat the Blue Jays. Everything was terrific. And then the bottom fell out. And they were, I think, what were we, like 24 and 48 or something like that at one point. And it was like, this stinks. And then by the end of the year, I think even internally there was some thought that this team might be headed for some down years. That was the beginning, really, of other teams finally being able to hire away people that had made the Rays successful. And let's not kid ourselves. The reason they do that is because I don't care how much your team is worth. Every owner in baseball is trying to figure out how can we win and spend the least amount of money that we have to. So, they're trying to get what is this quote-unquote secret sauce that the Rays have. So Joe Maddon is gone and Andrew Friedman is gone. And eventually this has become a trend throughout the game that other teams try to figure out how do they do this by hiring people away. James Click, Chaim Bloom, Charlie Montoyo, Rocco Baldelli, the
Matt Arnold, Derek
Matt
Shelton.
Arnett, yeah. Dan Epstein. There's just so many of them. And that was the beginning of it. And I'll give the Rays this. I think they thought that there might be a bit of a step back, but they, and people may not agree, but they never really tanked it, so to speak. They never really did what the Cubs did or what the Astros did or what several other teams have done. They never really tore it down to the nubs. They could have done that at any number of times. They were trying to get better while still being at least competitive in the big leagues. And the only year that they really, really stunk was 2016.
Mm-hmm.
The other years they were around a 500 team or so, or a little bit below it. But I give them credit for not tearing it completely down to the studs when they could have. And then once they start delving into some of the quirky things, whether it be the opener or so some of the platoons and the shifting and all that, that's when they started to get better. The only way the Rays get better is by doing it their way. It's never going to work here if they do things conventionally and the way that other teams do it. And that's how they've done it. That's how they've gotten, a better record. What are we, 4 or 5 straight years the team's had a better record?
Yeah, I mean, we went from that 16 season where things were, and I just remember everybody was talking about, they're going to hit all these homers, and Brad Miller had a 30-homer season. And I was like, it's like, yeah, they hit like 800 homers, and they scored 801 runs. And so,
we scored fewer runs, even though we were hitting more home runs. So big deal.
I know, and I just was like, this was kind of ridiculous. But yeah, you went, you mentioned it. 15, they were 80-82. They had the bad year in 16, but then they were 80-82. In 17, and then they won 90 games in 2018, and then 96 in 19, and we know they went 40-20 last year. So it's been a crazy ascension, but that brings us to this year, and the question marks are out there, and you trade away Blake Snell, you decide to decline the option on Charlie Morton, thinking that you might be able to get him for a couple of million bucks less, and he decides to go to Atlanta for what he was going to make. And you've made these moves now, and some of the big names that were here and were supposed to be big parts of what was going to be 2021 are not. What is the beginning of 2021 look like for you?
Well, expectations will be tempered, and I'm comfortable with that.
Yeah.
I'm much more comfortable with that because I love the fact that people, they still haven't learned to not underestimate the Rays. Somehow, some way, this team will be a challenger. Would they have been a better team with Snell and Morton? Yes. There is no question about it. That does feel like a step back. I think they need to add something to make up for that. To me, the Blake Snell deal is a painful one because there's 3 years left on that deal. It's one thing when you kind of knew the thing was going to be happening with David Price because he was coming up on free agency within a year or so. But when a guy still has 3 years left and you're coming off a World Series berth, an American League championship, that was a stunner. I know that it had been speculated. I thought there was more of an opportunity, more of a chance at least, that they would trade Kiermaier than Snell. It's not hard to figure out who makes the most money on the team, but my guess, and I don't know this, but my guess is that finances force things to happen. And also, maybe even as important as that, is that the Rays must have been overwhelmed with the return that the Padres were willing to give back, headed by Patino. Because they did not have to trade Blake Snell. They didn't have to. They must have thought that moving forward, while it certainly feels like a step back right now, let's not forget, too, that the Rays, for whatever reason, did not feel that Blake Snell was going to be able to go third time through lineups. Hence, they felt so strong about it that they took him out in Game 6 of the World Series. The guy was throwing a shutout. So they must have been overwhelmed with what they got back from the Padres. And look, we haven't been down to spring training, so I don't know all the inside story by any means. But that, knowing the Rays' history, they must have loved what the Padres were offering and feeling like not only for this year but moving forward, this was going to give them a chance to continue to be a good team. But there is something to be said about morale, and I think morale right now is a little bit stunned because Blake and Charlie won't be there. So guess what? Opportunity for other people, and that's just going to have to be the way it's going to be.
Yeah, seeing I think you're right about they didn't have to trade Blake Snell, but when you see what's coming up and you look at what Eric Neander and Carlos Rodriguez and Peter Bendix have been able to do with the minor league system, and you see, we've got some of these names that are going to be, some impact, whether it's, at the start of 2021, in the middle of 2021, or even the end of 2021, you go, okay, I kind of get it. Wander Franco is the name. And I remember Dick Vitale saying to me, even in the middle of last year, we need to bring up Wander Franco, baby. Oh my God, Wander Franco. And I looked at Dick and I said, have you watched Wander Franco play? And he went, I haven't seen him, but he's awesome, baby. He's Wander Franco. And I said, I've seen him play. I went and watched him play. I saw him with the Stone Crabs in 2019. There was a day off that the Rays had, and the Stone Crabs were in Clearwater taking on the Threshers. And I went, you know what? I'm going to go watch Wander Franco play in a game. And then I went over last spring before the pandemic. I was the only media guy that drove to West Palm Beach to watch Wander Franco play against the Washington Nationals because I wanted to see Wander Franco play. And I said to Dick, I said, Wander Franco is everything that you want, but, and there's the but, as we get back to the beginning of our conversation, you know, there right now, Wander Franco is a, we love you, you're great, but. Wander Franco hasn't gotten to the "we love you, you're great" and portion yet, and I said, right. "I have serious issues with Wander Franco when it comes to the point where most players seem like they're ready for Major League Baseball first, and that's defensively. My concern with Wander Franco is I don't know if he's a Major League shortstop because he has a tendency, and I don't know if this is a want to or a have to yet. He loves to play balls off to the side. He loves that backhand. He loves to scoop up balls backhanded, and that's going to bite him in the rear end in the big leagues. And I think he might be better off suited being a third baseman at the big league level. But I said he's everything you want in a prospect. But Franco, with Brendan McKay coming back at some point, with Shane Boz, and we saw Shane Boz at summer camp this year throwing 98 miles an hour and going, ooh. Mm-hmm. I watched him and went, that's nice. That no wonder why Neil Huntington lost his job. But I still think that there's more to come. By the time we get down to spring training here in a couple of weeks, I think that there's still going to be more additions. Now, are they going to be the additions that Rays fans want? Probably not. But I think that, if there's one thing that I've learned about this front office is you have to believe in them because they know exactly where they're going.
Yeah, at what point do Rays fans trust the fact that they know what they're doing? I mean, I guess, look, I understand it from a fan standpoint. Certainly, it's tough. When I found out we were trading Snell, it certainly knocked me back a little bit. But then you really have to trust what they're doing because they're doing things that are extremely – they are threading a needle with this franchise. What scares me is that, are we cursed in a sense? 2008, you expect that big afterglow the next year, but that was when the recession hit. And, just Dave used to say this, and I steal his line here, just because the team got good doesn't mean that you got an extra $100 in your pocket to go bring your family to a game. So it's not like you got a massive attendance boost after that. And here we are. The Rays were great and had this tremendous run that everybody was excited about, and it was awesome, and you got to the World Series, but we're in the middle of a pandemic, and finances are strapped for everybody, and people are out of their jobs, and it's limited fans at best at the ballpark. So they've never been able to really reap the rewards of winning a pennant like most other teams get a chance to. And between that and the stadium issue, and then the labor issue with baseball coming at the end of 2021, there's a lot of unsteadiness, in the game right now that I'm looking forward to being past that within hopefully a year or so and some of these things getting answered. But in terms of the team moving forward, the Rays are going to be a good team. Are they going to be as good as last year? I don't know. It's going to be different. Just like last year was different, I think they'll be a good team. I think they'll be a good representative team. And then if some of those young guys can get better, then this team could certainly make a run. And for anyone that loves to underestimate the Rays, I welcome them to underestimate them, and we'll see you in October.
It's the next beginning, my friend. I appreciate you giving me now an hour of your time. This has been way too much fun, and I know that I'll be bugging you again.
Anytime, my friend, we'll be around. Congratulations on your new show.
My thanks to Andy Freed for joining me, and apologies to Casey and Maddie Freed for taking your dad away from you for over an hour. I promise next time it will not be quite that long. This podcast is the beginning of something that I'm calling St. Pete Nine. It's a website devoted to the Rays and baseball that should be launching here in the next week or so. I'll let you know for sure exactly when it goes live, but it looks like it should be sometime right around the start of pitchers and catchers reporting to spring training next week. So follow us on Twitter at UTOR Podcast, and you get all the latest updates there, and we'll let you know when the site goes live. Thank you for joining us today. My name is Steve Carney, and you have been Under the Orange Roof.